Hi, I'm Tony Cameron Brown.
And I'm Benedict Evans.
Today we want to talk about one piece of your giant presentation. We actually haven't talked about your presentation, so this feels good to chat or to pull out one topic,
yep.
Which seems to be a very topical topic to talk about right now, which is Amazon's billion-dollar advertising industry, which is at currently 40 billion. Or 38.
It is, yeah. Well, so what's going on in the world? We're not going to talk about SVB because...
Run through the list of all the things we're not going to talk about.
Well, I'm not a banks analyst. There's people who actually understand what's going on much better than me. And so I'm not going to talk about SVB. We've done about 5 podcasts in a row about generative machine learning, and I'm about to publish something about generative machine learning and search. And so we thought we would take a break from this. Even though in some ways it does feel like it's the only topic
really
that there is
in
tech at the moment. But there is other stuff going on in the world, and there is other shit going on. And so I thought we'd talk about Amazon.
Yeah, what's the context here?
So the context is a couple of years ago, as Amazon has a different breakout of its revenue in the back of the accounts, and there's a line in there called Other. And a couple of years ago, the line called Other started getting quite big. And the footnote said this was predominantly advertising. And then at, I think, the end of 2021, they had to give a breakout. And it turned out it was all advertising. And last year, it was $38 billion. And $38 billion is bigger than the global newspaper industry, which, of course, is now much reduced. It's also bigger than Amazon Prime. It's almost certainly more profitable than AWS. And we can go in and talk about what that means and how difficult it is to say that meaningfully. And it's this entire, and it's this kind of whole newfound thing.
One question, because I remember you, and I think it was 2020 or 2021 when you discovered that chart with Udda, and you were just like, we don't know what's in it. And I distinctly remember you looking at that chart and having that conversation. Do we know, and this might not be relevant or even an interesting question, but do we know what prompted Amazon to start actually breaking down what was in Udda?
Oh, I just think it's financial regulation. I just think it became sufficiently large that they were obliged to tell people. It's just a consequence of how financial disclosure works, that it's after a certain point you have to tell people.
That's a fascinating. Yeah, you've gotten so big at some point that we've got questions and we're going to need more details. Okay.
Yeah, you're sufficiently large that you have to tell people now. So that's the answer to that. Now what they don't do is do a P&L. So the P&L that they
yes.
do is they do a P&L. They do revenue and operating profit for US International and AWS. And a couple of other bits and pieces. I don't have it in front of me now, but they don't do operating profit for this. And so there's a couple of sort of ways you can look at this. So one of them is, as I said, this is like very profitable found money. Like they don't have to charge, they don't have a very high operating cost for doing this. There's basically no very little incremental capex because it's sitting on the existing, on all the existing infrastructure.
And is this the start contracts with AWS, which requires investment in property, equipment, everything that it takes to operate cloud business?
It's a whole other thing. Whereas selling ads on the existing website, where you need people to do that, but you don't need like a whole new set of people to run all the infrastructure because most of the infrastructure is all there, and you don't need to build like $100 billion and more servers to run that because you've already got more. And so you're sort of free riding to some extent on the existing infrastructure and cost base. And so $48 billion. Google's operating profit, if you remove TAC, which is what they pay Apple to be the default search engine, and if you remove technology R&D, then you get like a 60% operating margin. So if you apply that to $40 billion, you get whatever it is, over $20 billion, which is roughly the same as AWS. So roughly equivalent operating profit as AWS, and without AWS is $10 or $20 billion of capex attached to it. So like giant new profitable business. Haha. Okay, that's the first way of looking at it. However, the more interesting thing is to say that it's not really a standalone business. And the dumb thing is to say, yes, it's not a standalone business because you couldn't have it without the rest of Amazon. The more important point, I think, is to say, could you do a P&L for Prime? So this is more revenue than Prime. But Prime has the subscription fee and it has the costs of buying the TV shows and the costs of shipping it to you a bit quicker. But it also has all of the extra revenue that results from the fact that Prime is there. And where would you calculate that and account for that? I mean, Amazon in their accounts say we don't count this as a marketing cost, but we think it's marketing. So what would a P&L for Prime actually look like? It's kind of like saying, what's the P&L for the Apple App Store? Well, the purpose of the App Store is to sell iPhones. I mean, it has revenue and it has a cost base, but it also sells iPhones. And so, kind of taking this a step further, you can certainly look at this and say, is this advertising or is this marketing? In that we kind of forget that search ads are generally referred to as SEM, which stands for marketing. Is it an ad or is it an inducement? Are you paying? What about if you pay? Because if you pay a retailer for end caps, if you pay a retailer to put your product on the shelf, if you pay a product retailer to give your product more shelf space, if you pay a retailer to put it like by the checkout, then that's called marketing, not advertising. But that's almost as much money as advertising globally. It's a couple of $100 billion. So is a search ad advertising or marketing? Is an Amazon search ad advertising or is it marketing? Is that the equivalent of paying a retailer to put you on the end cap? Does it mean anything to argue about that? Well, like, what's the distinction?
Yeah, is
What
that a
would that look
helpful
like?
comparison? Yeah.
And then the third way you can look at it is you can say this is price discrimination. So you can say this is a way of getting people who have higher margins to give you more money. So instead of having like an individual team at Amazon having to go and haggle and bargain and trying to squeeze more money out of suppliers one at a time, when you've got 350 million SKUs, that doesn't really scale. Instead, you just say, well, we're not going to tell you that you have to pay us more. It's for you to decide. You can decide to buy placement. And if you've got the margin that will support buying placement, then you pay it. And if you don't, well, then it sucks to be you.
And that's a comparison you've done over the years with just traditional retail, more shelf life, isn't it? It's the same. You've got more money to spend to be up front and center.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a way of scaling that. So instead of saying, well, what we're going to require this marketing spend from you, or what marketing spend have you got? You just say, well, here's the platform. If you've got profit a bit, you could decide if you've got the ROI, you can give us more money. And so this is effectively a way for Amazon to squeeze more margin out of its suppliers, as much as it is advertising, which is kind of fascinating.
And it's gotten, is it safe to say that it's gotten quite a fair amount of backlash of people who may not understand that this isn't the traditional way of doing business, that if you've got more money, you spend more to be front and center, that people have been saying that this is kind of like falling into the monopoly.
Well, so maybe two ways of answering this. I mean, one of them would be that yes, like, what did you think those end caps were? Why did you think Coca-Cola had that great chunk of shelf space by the front door? Like, did you think that happened for free? No, they're paying for that. I mean, in fact, they employ people to go from store to store, like with measuring tapes, checking how much shelf space they've been given and whether they've got what they paid for. So that's one answer. Second answer would be that, a lot of people have kind of said you go to Amazon now and like all the first page of results are all ads and they may not necessarily be what you search for. Well, like,
Yeah.
yeah, if you go to the supermarket, the milk's at the back. Why do you think that is? It's so you have to walk past everything else. You go to the supermarket, there's lots of candy by the checkout. Why do you think that is? That's not like a coincidence. There's 75 years of people doing really detailed
Of doing
analysis
exactly
to
this.
do that. Like that's what retailing is. Like, yeah, like they don't make it that retailing like. Supermarkets are not laid out to make it efficient for you to find what you want. They are laid out to make it inefficient for you to find what you
And for you
want.
to spend more money.
Yes.
In a very weird parallel world, I don't know if you saw this, but because we've spoken about Mr. Beast previously, he put out a tweet a couple of days ago that said, I need your help next time you see Feastables, which is his chocolate company and his chocolate products. Next time you see Feastables in Walmart and soon to be new retails, could you clean up the presentation and make it look better? That would make me extremely happy. I'm currently building a team to do this routinely.
Coke, yeah, that's what Coca-Cola has. And I guess what? Mr. Beast is not one person. We do understand this. He's like 300 people. There
But
is a
he's got
company.
an enormous amount of backlash for asking this, which, to your point, people have been doing and brands and companies have been doing
Yeah.
for years.
Procter and Gamble has had people doing this for 100 years. That's how it works. That's how a brand works. But there's a sort of thing we should say, so to kind of step back, it's like, yes, this is a new manifestation of something that's very old. But the other part is it's not just Amazon that's doing this. So Walmart did, I think, $2.7 billion of advertising last year. Uber is now at a $500 million run rate. And everyone, for obviously eBay and Pinterest and Etsy, want to do this. But also people like Target want to do it. Everyone wants to do this. And there's sort of two or three, like at a generalized level, there's a couple of things going on here. One of them is if you've got a supermarket, you don't really have advertising inventory. Like you can't really put up posters in a supermarket. But if you've got a website, well, a website's a website. And if you've got millions of people going to your website, then that is ad inventory, even if you don't think of yourself as a media company. And so that's what's going on with Uber, for example. If you've got an app that hundreds of millions of people look at, you can put an ad there, which was not the case with a retailer or taxi company in the past. Oh, actually, it's not true. Taxis obviously have had ads forever, but like if a retailer traditionally, you didn't have ads in that way. The second issue is that you have first party data. So this is the whole privacy thing, cookies, the IDFA. So the fact that you now you that a retailer, well, they know what you're buying. At the very least, if you go to Amazon and type in a search, then they can show you a search ad. More generally, they've got your account history, and so they know what else you've bought, so they can show you ads on that. They kind of know where you live, obviously. They've got some sense of how rich you are, whether you're a man or a woman, whether you've got children. So they can so they have first party data, which is opt-in, which you know you've consented to that they've got that data. And given that now they've kind of the other more kind of cross-site ways of advertising will be leak-apped, this has relatively much more value.
Yes, because we've moved away from scraping third-party data, all of that, and so we're focusing much more heavily on first-party data.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And we have what I think is actually a sort of slightly artificial idea that
That's a good way of
you
putting
can
it.
do whatever you want with data inside your own company, but sharing it between multiple companies is evil, which I find slightly perplexing. Like, I don't quite understand why it's okay for the New York Times to track you all month and show you an ad based on that, but not okay for you then to see the same ad on the New Yorker. Like,
That's a fascinating can of worms to open up one day.
that's a whole, I don't think there's like a coherent, rational reason why. But that's another podcast. The point is that apparently, so you have inventory, you have first party data. You also, of course, there's a margin structure point here. So the quote from Walmart is CEO of Walmart said, "I cannot remember a business that had the margin structure of advertising." Go back to what I said earlier, 40 to 50% operating margins. Guess what a retailer's profit margin is? Like 3% if you're lucky. Like actually 3% if you're lucky. And so a relatively small, so an advertising business that is a small percentage of your top line is going to produce a very disproportionate amount of bottom line, which makes it very, very tempting. What's the operating margin? So that's $2 or $3 billion of operating margin. I haven't looked at what Walmart's operating margins is, but it's a high percentage of Walmart's net income. And so all of those things combined mean there's a sort of gold rush towards people piling into merchant media. And WPP, not WPP, GroupM put out a forecast, a research report at the end of last year where they reckoned it was 10% of US advertising. They thought it was $100 billion last year globally. Like, woof, like this huge like explosion of this like inflating balloon of this bit of business, which is it's almost kind of, as I said earlier, it's like it's found money. Like no one kind of realized that it was there, and it's found money and free money.
It's found money, free money, and you put, there was a slide in your presentation that I feel it puts this even more into context, that this is when you know that we've got a decline of department stores and we've got a decline of newspaper share and advertising, and then you've got this popping up. And it's like, it's not the perfect storm is the wrong word for this, but I think it feels important to highlight what's happening here in context of decline of department stores, decline of newspapers, and then there's this that's happening over here.
Well, so part of the sort of the narrative of the presentation that I published last month, a couple of weeks ago, was I called it the new gatekeepers, and kind of part of my point was there were old gatekeepers, and they were generally much bigger and much more powerful than Google or Amazon. Which is kind of a counterintuitive thing to say, but we came from a world in which there were three TV stations, and most cities in America had one or maybe two newspapers, and there's like three or four big retailers, and that's kind of it. And that's certainly not what retailing or media looks like today.
And think of book publishers as another perfect example when you talk about old gatekeepers.
Yeah, exactly. And the kind of the point being that like for any sort of brand or retailer or anyone trying to reach a consumer or indeed any consumer, you've got kind of a logistics question of how do I get to it? And you've got a discovery question of like, how would I know what I wanted or what I want? And in the old world, like pre-1995, there's kind of relatively constrained logistics and relatively constrained retail and media. And obviously, those all kind of blur into one in a sense, but like there's only so many people who can do nationwide distribution to every Walgreens or Walmart or Macy's, and there's only so many people who can buy the back page of Vogue or do a nationwide TV buy. So you've got these kind of fundamental filters on how much stuff there can be and how many brands there can be and how many people can build a business and go to market, or at least how much capital you need to do that. And now those filters are basically gone, and there's infinite product and infinite media. And you see the microcosm of this in Amazon, going back to this people thing of people kind of complaining about the experience. Amazon has 350, 450 million SKUs. It has sufficiently many SKUs that it's actually not a very meaningful number, because an awful lot of that is just stuff that doesn't exist until someone orders it. And you know, make a thing and then you generate 45 different colors and you just put them in on Amazon as SKUs. But they don't actually exist until somebody buys them, or you've only made one. And so, like, it's not, it, a SKU on Amazon is not the same as a SKU in a supermarket. But anyway, the point is, it's basically infinite product. And so, how should Amazon decide what to put first in your search results? Well, first, like text match and traditional search, but also who's going to pay to be there. And if you're going to pay to be there, then the odds are that there's an ROI on that. And the only reason there's an ROI is that if you pay to be there, people buy it. And you know, that is actually a quality, kind of a quality filter. I mean, this is the argument that people had about search advertising 20 years ago. You know, when Bill Joy, and it was not Google, it was Bill Joy, first suggested paying to be at the top of search results, people thought this was evil and corrupt. It's like, no, it's like, if they're willing to pay to be there, it's because that's what you want. This is another signal for what you want. And so you can see, you know, just as, I mean, you know, what's the phrase from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? We're not one at a timing, we're mass communicating. And Amazon doesn't want one at a time anything. So they don't want a one at a time screwing margin out of brands. They let the brands bid away their own margin. They also don't want one at a time what product you range. So you open up the product APIs to marketplace. And so now you don't have to have a product team for that product to be on Amazon. Somebody else can be the product team, and you don't even know they exist, and they don't work for you. They're just putting the product on marketplace. And then the same with ads. You, how do you decide what goes at the front? What do you, how do you decide what you range? You don't have to. You let them bid for it.
And there's an interesting, when we're talking about like putting everything into context, where my question goes when I was reading your piece is like the big advertising question right now seems to be, where is your audience? Where are they spending their time? What is their spending habits? And another platform that we've got to talk about and look at is obviously TikTok. And it looks like, I think it was last year their TikTok's ad revenue was 11 billion, I think, which is pretty high, and they're expecting that to grow this year. But one of the biggest trending hashtags on TikTok is TikTok made me buy it. And obviously, this is people on TikTok with an Amazon storefront with all of the gadgets and gizmos, and those have a popularity sometimes of selling out
Yeah,
completely.
or Shopify.
Or Shopify.
Well, this is a social selling thing that's been a huge thing, been a huge, it's been a huge thing in China for years, and no one's ever quite managed to get it work to work. And, you know, Amazon advertising, TikTok advertising is doing okay, not where it could be relative to the time it has. TikTok selling, TikTok e-commerce, you know, one hears pretty kind of ambivalent things about it. Like they create, they, I don't think they got to where they wanted to get to on it. But it does kind of speak to that point of like, how do you know it exists? How would you know that you wanted to buy it? How, where would it come from? But it's also, it's like, not to get, you know, kind of, it's going to sound kind of pretentious, but like the Friedrich Hayek sort of argument that in a free market system, price is a signaling mechanism, price is an information system. The fact that this is cheap there and expensive there, the fact that that has high margins or low margins, is an information system that prompts people to do things and behave in different ways, to buy more or make more, or buy less or make less, which is a thing that sort of communist central planners could never understand. The pricing isn't like noise. The pricing is the point. The pricing is a system. It's that pricing is determining what gets made. And this is what, in a sense, what Amazon is doing with the marketplace, and it's what it's doing with ads. It's we will make discovery a pricing system.
And it's so interesting you say that. I was looking at a product and I found there's like hundreds of storefronts that were selling this one product. And I was looking at it going, the same product is selling for, let's say, $22 or $32. And I was like, well, I'm going to buy the product that's selling it at $30, right slam in the middle. And I don't know why, but emotionally it feels correct to not buy the cheapest or not get ripped off by the most expensive. But there's no logic.
Oh well, so there's a whole field on this,
Oh,
which
I
is
know.
it's like, if you present somebody with a range of numbers, which one will they choose?
It's
And
what
the
used to
arm
sell
and the arm
software as of the middle.
well, no, it's more like you can use it for like card tricks and for gambling and so on. If you ask people to choose a number between 1 and 10, they will never choose 1, 5, or 10. They're like more likely to choose
The
three or
three or the
seven.
seven.
Because they think it's more random.
Which the fact that we both said three or seven at the same time is exactly
Yeah.
like that. There you go. Proof is in the pudding, as they say.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
people it's, you know, it's people have problems with
It's
random numbers,
fascinating.
with probability distribution. But that and this is the you know, going back to the terms of Amazon advertising, I mean,
Yeah.
there's another sort of angle here, which is the unbundling of Google. because clearly, what's happened in the last decade or so is product search has moved almost entirely from Google to Amazon. Like, it's as soon as you know what you want, you go, you might, well, you don't go to Shopify, which is obviously a whole other conversation. Shopify is not yet a consumer-facing brand. It doesn't have, there's no place you could go, and not, you would, that's not what you would do. But once you know what you want, you'd either go to a very specialist retailer, but more probably you would go to Amazon. If you know exactly the product you want, you'll go to Amazon, as opposed to Google. And so that product search has moved there almost entirely. And obviously, what Google is trying to do with machine learning is now to say, well, if you don't know what it is, we'll tell you what it is. We'll have image search, where Amazon is way behind. So the problem, of course, is then you basically use Google image search for showrooming, and then you go to Amazon anyway. There's a chart I used to show, I haven't shown for a year or two, of Google Trends data for best versus cheap.
I remember that.
Sure, I've shown this to you, and it's a perfect cross. So it used to be that cheap was high. Cheap has gone from high to low. Best has gone from low to high. And the story, the hypothesis here is that people used to use the internet for a price comparison. You already knew what you wanted. You went to Google and searched for cheap X. Over time, that's gone down, and best or good X has gone up, because you don't know, you use Google as a for curation, recommendation, discovery. You go to Google to ask what to buy, as opposed to, I already know what I want, and where is the right place to get it from.
Give me the most affordable version of it,
Yeah.
yeah.
Now, of course, there's also a generative machine learning angle to this, of
Of
course.
course there is.
Because first of all, might change the form of what the answer to that question might be, but also might produce different kinds of answers, or point you into different point you in different directions. That's fully, again, like another rabbit hole to go down a different time. But it sort of fascinates me in general, looking at Amazon, that, like, on the one hand, there's all this interesting stuff about how it scales. It's the machine to make the machine. Which goes back to, like, the idea that everything is an internal API, and everything is an internal team, and everything is internally transparent. And you don't launch by getting a meeting. You launch by just plugging into the APIs, and the people who run the APIs don't need to know you exist. But there's like this combination. On one hand, like, the invention is how to scale, but most of what it actually does is stuff that retailers were doing in 1950 or 1900, or even like 1860, 1870. Like, private label goods was always a hilarious thing. I mean, that the freak out around private label goods has now sort of mostly receded. I think most people have kind of now realized, like, yes, that's what every retailer has done since about 1850. Everyone wanted to talk about Amazon private label.
In 2020, 2021, that was the one thing that kept coming up, and it was
Yeah.
just like a ridiculous take.
It was like, have you never been into a supermarket? Like, what do you think that thing that says Tesco's finest is? Do you think, like, where do you think that came from? What do you think that is?
That little bundle that you're buying with their wine and their dinner and their dessert.
Yeah, exactly. Single person special. Yeah.
We've both outed ourselves.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just imagining. Like, but yes, it's a kind of I used to say that, that the thing from Back to the Future, where the guy's got, like, the sports almanac in a safe behind his desk, the Back to the Future sequel, again, aging ourselves. And I used to joke that Jeff Bezos has a safe behind his desk, and in the safe is a retail encyclopedia from about 1972. And it's full of post-it notes, and all he's doing is just kind of working his way through, like credit cards, accounts, private label goods, shipping, returns, over and over again. Like, oh, there it is. That's what they do. That's what retailing is. But you have this kind of funny combination of, on one hand, you can look at Amazon ads and say, retailers, as I said myself earlier, retailers couldn't do advertising before. And so this is a new thing, and it's a new way of making retail, for a retailer to make brands bid their margin down against each other, which they couldn't do before. Like, Walmart doesn't run auctions for space in the shelves. But on the other hand, Walmart charges retail. Well, actually, Walmart actually doesn't do that directly. They just demand discounts from people. On the other hand, retailers have been charging for space for as long as they've been retailers. So it's like a combination of what's old is new, but also you're doing it in this kind of, interesting, conceptually new sort of a way.
I like the idea that he's going for a playbook of 1950. On the topic of retail, do you think this is the end? And this is a bit of an off-topic question, but do you think this is the end of the suburban mall? Is this the end of the suburban mall?
Well, so there's a chart in my presentation of retail square foot per capita, in which the US has like 5 to 10 times more retail square foot per capita than anywhere else, and half of that is malls, in which the US has basically massively overinvested in physical retail space in the last sort of 20 to 30 years, I suppose.
Because that's a fascinating, it's more of a human than a tech story, but just that it is often like the beating heart in America of that city, that region, and just now you walk through them and it's just like empty shop spaces.
And I wonder, you know, if the US, there's a whole sort of social story about what it was like going to a shopping mall and so on. And, you know, that there's been kind of conversations for kind of the last like 5 years, maybe longer, as to, even 10 years, as to like, how do you repurpose dead malls? Because, you know, no question the US has, you know, radically more physical retail space than it did in the past. Now, that said, I don't think anyone thinks that physical retail space is just kind of going to go away. You know, it's just that, you know, you have to ask, well, why do you have it? You know, what purpose is it serving?
How are you using it?
Yes, yeah. What is this? And why are you doing it? Because it doesn't exist purely because that was, you know, there's retail sort of on a sort of multi-dimensional spectrum, from retail as the endpoint to a logistics chain, and retail as its service, experience, discovery, recommendation, something other than simply the most efficient way to get this. And of course, physical retail can be the most efficient way to get it. You know, if you want to, you know, if it's sort of 6 o'clock in the evening and you realize you're about to run out of milk, then you're probably going to go to a physical retailer. You're probably not going to order it online. Except, you know, yes, of course, there's 1 hour grocery delivery, but you know, it's still for most people the most efficient way is
actually physically get in your car and drive down the
street. Walk down to the bottom of the road. So that's not going to go away. And you know, they will continue to be in all sorts of places, you know, fields where physical retail remains.
It's like, but it's more the utility that they serve.
Yes, but there will be, you know, there will be places where physical retail remains just the most efficient logistics pattern. And that's the only reason you're doing it is because the logistics are better. But there's clearly also going to be a bunch of places in which that goes away, and you exist in physical retail for recommendation, service, curation, discovery, something along those lines, because the pure logistics side then becomes served more efficiently by the internet. And, you know, we'll see. Yeah. But yes, all of those shopping malls do kind of have an interesting kind of conceptual problem, which they've all been talking about. But it is fascinating just to look at that data, and to look at how hard it was to get that data, like the actual real numbers, but also just to get that to see that chart that the US just has radically more retail square foot per capita than anywhere else.
Because I couldn't help but I remember when I saw that graph, I'd forgotten that graph, but living in America, I had this sneaky feeling of, wait, is this just, am I just seeing this because I'm in America and it feels like a very American problem, or is this actually a thing that's happening elsewhere? And I'm sure it's happening in other places, but it does, to your points, the numbers in America are pretty massive in terms of...
Yeah, in fact, ironically, you don't get it nearly as much if you live in Silicon Valley. Certainly not if you live in San Francisco. You don't kind of have that same sense of like the ubiquity of shopping malls. And did sort of sometimes occur to me that actually San Francisco is the San Francisco Bay Area, which is basically endless urban sprawl, is actually a much more accurate reflection of what the majority of America is like than San Francisco, than San Francisco or New York. There's a reason why New York is sort of floating on an island in the Atlantic. It's basically a European city. Most of America doesn't look like that.
And maybe to just close it out, when we know that like the Amazon's advertising business right now is at $38 billion. Do we know if this number is expected to plateau? If this number is expected to grow more,
it's not going to go. It's not going to go to $1 trillion, is it? But
here first, people.
Yes, it's not. It's not. It's not slowing down. Put it like that. And you know, the kind of the generalized kind of comment that I always kind of make talking about this is that, you know, it used to be that you had a retail budget, retail rent, or as a brand, you have, if you have your own stores, then you have the rent and all the operating cost of the stores. And if you're just selling wholesale, then you're giving retailers a wholesale margin of like anything from kind of 25 to 40, 50% of the cover prices, the retailer margin. And then there's an advertising budget, and there's a shipping budget and a returns budget, and, you know, right down to, you know, what do you pay for credit card interchange and everything else. It's like everything that you pay below the gross margin line, is how is it that you get the product to the consumer? All of that is now sort of up for grabs. You know, in the past, you couldn't say, should we open a city, or should we open shops in that city, or just advertise there? Or should we open shops in that country, or just advertise there? And now that's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. You know, should we do a, how do we go to market? Do we do a nationwide TV buy? And again, that's an option. It's a question, you know, and in the past, it wasn't really a question.
I like that. The questions that we are, and essentially that's where we always kind of land with these episodes, but the questions that we are asking are changing and look different. And that's what we should be paying attention to.
Yep. Okay. That seems like a good place to round up. Round up, and then we'll
It
get. Then we
does.
can go back to thinking about generative machine learning.
Quick, let's get back to it. That was a 30-minute break out of your day on all things generative ML. Talk
Speak
to
to
you
you
soon.
later. Bye.
Bye.